Hello and welcome to the Journeymen Podcast. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
Join us as we travel from club to club, delving into the stories, tales and myths that have helped to find the ethos and identities of football clubs all over the world.
We'll look at club history from all angles, whether it be the team's tactical style, superstitious fan rituals, or discussing the best players to grace the shirt.
For our base in Berlin, we aspire to give clubs of all sizes the platform to discuss their greatest triumphs and toughest heartbreaks.
We'll take you through fascinating untold stories with tales of heroes, villains, promotions, relegations, and everything in between.
And here we are for episode 4 of the Journeymen Podcast. In episode 3, we were up in the north of Scotland, talking about Aberdeen Football Club, legends like Fergie and that amazing Cup Winners' Cup winning team in the mid-80s.
I massively enjoyed it, massively enjoyed also the reaction we got from Aberdeen fans. So thanks everyone for giving it a listen. Thanks for entering the shirt competition. And yeah, make sure you're following us for more giveaways like that.
And to link us into our brand new team, we'll be talking about Aberdeen, but in a different Cup Winners' Cup campaign. This one, they lost in the semi-finals to the team we'll be covering in the 1983-84 season. Can you tell us, Mark, who is the club?
I can. So if you played Pro Evolution Soccer 3 and 4, they were called Porto. It is FC Porto in Portugal. Sadly, they're fully licensed now, so it's not as interesting. But yes, FC Porto in Portugal. We've done it again. We're at another port, and literally, it's called Port this time.
We're linking into this team because Aberdeen had won the Cup Winners' Cup the year prior, but then this year, they were beaten by Porto over two legs from goals with Fernando Gomez in the first leg and Vermelhinho in the second leg with a convincing 2-0 win.
Fernando Gomez, that's a name to remember for later on. He pops up quite a lot. But yeah, let's get into it. So what's your sort of previous, we always sort of do this thing, previous knowledge of FC Porto?
For me, I can't say I knew loads about the club prior to simply their Champions League glory in the noughties and, well, the legend that is Jose Mourinho, but I'm sure you have much more to say about him, obviously being a Chelsea fan yourself.
Definitely, definitely so. And a lot of player links as well to Porto. Obviously, Mourinho's European glory that sort of springboarded him to fame and his job in the Premier League with Chelsea and all the players he brought with him, and also just their incredible ability to just constantly keep finding South American talent, nurturing it and then selling them for huge amounts of money, usually to Chelsea or Man City or another Premier League team. But yeah,
this is one of the misconceptions that I originally had, is that I thought it was just this brilliant youth academy system, but it's a little bit different, and we'll be touching on it in part two most likely about just how they run the things, how they find their players and how they bring through these talents and nurture them into the millions and millions of pounds that they offload them.
Here we go. This is what it's all about. Porto, pick of Europe again as winners of the UEFA Champions League.
Before into the club itself, let's set the scene. We'll have some location geography as well as the football geography. So location-wise, the club is based in the city of Porto, obviously, in the northeast of Portugal, and it's the second largest city in Portugal, the metropolitan area of around 1.7 million people.
After recording and doing an episode about the Scottish team, Aberdeen, and now we're in the middle of a German winter, very cold, we thought we'd treat ourselves with a nice bit of sunshine in northeast Portugal.
And a bit of Portuguese sun. And I love the fact this is our fourth episode, and it wasn't remotely intentional, but it's the fourth team that's on a port. Like, literally, the name is Port. Maybe one day we'll cover a club that's not near water. Maybe.
We'll see. We'll see. We can't promise anything here at the Journeyman Podcast, but we'll see.
Maybe to make up for it, we need to do, like, Nottingham, Derby, Leicester next.
Or maybe, like, a team based in, like, Liechtenstein, because that's, like, one of the most landlocked countries in the world.
Yeah. So with a port, naturally, you've got industry, and Porto is no different.
An old Portuguese saying goes that Braga pays, Coimbra studies, Lisbon entertains, but Porto works.
And it's one of the oldest European centres. It's the core of the city was proclaimed a World Heritage Site by UNESCO in 1996. And it's a settlement, you know, that dates back many centuries when it was an outpost of the Roman Empire, where its combined Celtic Latin name, Portus Cale, has been referred to as the origin of the name Portugal.
So similar to the name Porto, port wine, or Vino do Porto, is one of Portugal's most famous exports and is named after the city. Since the metropolitan area, and in particular the cellars of Vila Nova de Gaia, were responsible for the packaging, transport and export of this fortified wine.
Very interestingly, the city is most notably twinned with Bristol in the UK, as well as Liège in Belgium and Bordeaux in France, which I wasn't expecting that. I don't know whether there's a a relationship between Bristol City and Porto that we haven't stumbled upon yet, maybe.
The nicknames of the city include the Cicada de Invintiga, the unvanquished city in English. It's also known as the City of Bridges, or the Cicada des Pontes, with six bridges crossing the Douro, which is where the city is based. Or lastly, and simply, Capital do Norte, the capital of the north.
Nice. And I think that brings us nicely to the football geography. So Porto's current home, the Estadio de Dragão, is based in the northeast of the city, but it's still very central. It holds up to 50,000 people and is the third biggest stadium in Portugal. One interesting thing we came across, like sort of understanding how big of a club Porto are, is the amount of members, isn't it?
From some of the figures that we managed to find, they have over 125,000 members. So comparing this to the Bundesliga figures that we have, another league that's dominated by fan-owned or fan-influenced clubs, that figure would make them the fourth most followed team behind Bayern, Schalke and Dortmund, and just popping in ahead of Köln by about 23,000 into that fourth place spot.
And the stadium itself is a UEFA Category 4 stadium, which is the highest grade that can be achieved. It's held several big international club games, national team competition matches, including the 2019 Nations League final and the 2021 Champions League final.
Which your team, Mark, beat Manchester City 1-0 last year in a battle of the state backing versus oligarch backing in the biggest European game.
Bring it on, King Kai. It was great.
The construction of the stadium finished in 2003, and the stadium was inaugurated with a match against Barcelona, which featured the debut of a little-known 16-year-old youngster who goes by the name of Lionel Messi. You might have heard of him. But regardless of this big debutant star making his first game, Porto managed to win 2-0.
I'm sure that keeps Messi awake every single night. No amount of Ballon d'Ors is going to, you know, make up for losing as a 16-year-old in Porto's first ever game at the stadium. Yeah. Although that's their current home, they've actually had three other venues which they've called home. So as we go through the club, we'll touch on those places. But yeah, I found that quite interesting. They've had four stadiums. Obviously, like in England, we're used to like most clubs are probably only just getting like their second stadium. Most are still in their original site.
Or if they're just trying to revamp their old stadiums from the 50s, from the 60s, from even like the 20s and 30s, some stadiums, depending on where they are in the UK.
Exactly. So from the city and stadium that they call home, we'll move towards the clubs that they call enemies.
In Porto, there's the local rivalry with city rivals Boa Vista, called the O Derby de Vitiga, referencing the nickname of the city, as we mentioned before.
Yeah, and also there's the Porto and Lisbon city rivalry, which stems from historical, political, economical and cultural clashes between the cities of Porto and Lisbon. So two big cities that are not fans of each other.
This rivalry is born outside of football. It transcends football. It's similar to like things maybe you could say in the UK where it's like Manchester and Liverpool.
Yeah, and that brings us to the so-called big three in Portugal. So obviously, we've got Porto, Sporting and then Benfica. And so since the league was actually formed in 1934, clubs outside the big three have won the title just twice.
Very domineering, almost as dominant as Celtic and Rangers, as we touched on last episode. Only 9 players have played for all three sides, crossing this tri-divide, Manish being the most notable player, and only 4 managers have also managed to do this three-club rivalry, manage them all, with Fernando Santo, who's currently the national team coach, being the most notable manager to do so.
So the game with Benfica, this tie is actually known as the O Clásico, or the Classic. Porto are the second most decorated team in Portugal with 79 trophies behind Benfica, who are on 83. However, Porto fans do have the trump card that they can play that they've dominated Portugal in terms of European trophies with 5 compared to Benfica's 2.
And then the other side of this three-way fight is Sporting CP. Their derby with Porto is known as the Dragones versus Leones, or Dragons versus Lions, and they've faced off 239 times. And despite playing this fixture an incredible amount of times, it's still really, really tight in the head-to-head record. Porto edge it with 86 wins to Sporting's 83, and 70 draws between the two as well. So it's still all to play for right now in the modern day.
Yes! Brilliant goal! Oh, that is a real moment of class. That's why he's in the team. Didn't matter that he was back at 11:30 last night after a tortuous trip.
Wow, well, he must have travelled first class, because I tell you what, he's been superb. He's been Porto's best player all night. Porto's best player this season. And we said about how if they are to create something, they've got to get him on the ball.
So let's start at the very beginning. The club was founded in September 1893 as Football Club de Porto by a guy called Antonio Nicolau de Almeida, who was a local port wine merchant and avid sportsman.
Almeida had become fascinated with football during his trips to England, and Porto played its first matches with other Portuguese clubs, including one against Lisbon's Football Club Lisbonese in March of 1894. This match was attended by King Carlos I of Portugal and Queen Amélie of Orléans, who travelled to Porto to witness the event and present trophies to the winners.
But by the turn of the century, Almeida's enthusiasm and involvement with the club declined due to family pressure and personal problems, meaning the club entered a period of inactivity.
In 1906, José Montero da Costa returned to Porto after finishing his studies in England. Like Almeida, 13 years before, he was also captivated by the English game, and together with some associates, decided to reintroduce the practice of football to the city.
So the club was reborn again under Montero da Costa after these years of inactivity. During August 1906, da Costa was appointed the club president, and the football was the main focus, but he also promoted other sports like gymnastics, weightlifting, wrestling, athletics and swimming, so it was like an all-round sports club for the city, basically.
And this is still something they promote to this day. When you go on their website, you can go and look at the handball team, gymnastics, weightlifting and all this type of thing, which is something that I feel English clubs don't quite embrace the same way that Mediterranean clubs, I'd say, in particular like Barcelona as well, is one off the top of my head, who are like a huge basketball team, and also the Greek teams as well with their basketball.
I was going to say the Turkish clubs as well, like, and I've seen like Fenerbahce, and so they have like tons and tons of different sports and teams and things, yeah.
The colours chosen for the club were blue and white, the same colours as the national flag at the time, and not the colours of the city's flag, because according to José Montero, Football Club de Porto would not limit itself by defending only the name of the club. It would take the name of Portugal in sports fights against other foreign cities and clubs around the world.
Yeah, so this guy clearly had big ambitions, very passionate about sport and football in particular, and he wasted no time in building their first ever like proper purpose-built stadium, the Campo de Reina, or Queen's Field, which was conveniently built on the same street as his house.
And even for the time, on the land Montero da Costa rented for the club, they built the football pitch surrounded by a running track, stands for seats for spectators, over 600 of them, including a VIP section. It even had changing rooms which were equipped with showers, sinks, a bar and even a gym. So for the like early 1900s, this is incredibly forward thinking.
Yeah, and it was also actually the first turf field in the country as well, another interesting quirk to it. Not quite as good as Aberdeen being the inventors of the dugout. That was a good revelation.
But considering that Aberdeen are only just talking about potentially getting a brand new stadium now, with some of these features that Montero da Costa had implemented in Porto nearly 100 years ago. You know, Aberdeen had the dugout, but hey, Montero had a bar and a gym, so hey, who's winning? I don't know. Well, I don't know. I'll let you guys figure that one out.
Well, I would pick the bar, but anyway. Porto's most senior player at the time was an Italian defender going by the name of Catulo Gadda. During a business trip to Portugal, Gadda had met Montero da Costa, who then managed to get him to sign for his newly founded club. And having joined the new team, he found himself as one of the most experienced players in the squad and began to take on the task of actually guiding his teammates on the field, and therefore is considered the first coach in the history of the club.
Whilst the details of this period are a little bit sketchy, we're guessing that Gadda's player-manager experiment didn't work too well, as Porto then appointed a French coach named Adolphe Cassagne just a year later, who would stay with the club until 1922, over 15 years.
During his 15-year reign, Cassagne would lead Porto to 7 regional titles, plus their first ever national title by winning the inaugural Portuguese Cup in 1922.
But to come back a little bit, by 1907, Porto had played their first ever match against a foreign team, hosting Spain's Real Fortuna. Real Fortuna would go on to be merged with another club in the local area and would become the modern-day Celta Vigo. In the following month, Porto would then return the visit and played its first match abroad as well.
4 years later, the club won the inaugural staging of the Taça José Montero da Costa Cup. So this is a cup actually named after the guy who came back, set up the club, built the stadium on the street of his house and wanted to, you know, take them to the next level. And when we first saw this, it was like, oh God, he's just invented a cup after himself as well as doing all of this. But actually, we found out he actually tragically died at the age of 29 in the same year. And so the club then created this trophy as a memorial to him. But it had some interesting rules to it. So teams were required to field an all-Portuguese squad. The winners would host the tournament in the following year, and the first team to win it 3 consecutive times would become the outright winners. So essentially, this tournament would go on forever until someone wins it 3 consecutive times. Porto won it in the first 2 years, but then lost in 1913 when they would have like ended it. Then the following year, Porto recovered their title and won the cup definitely after securing their 3rd consecutive title in 1916.
To put this mad rule into a bit of modern context, the Champions League would have come to an end, finished, in 2018 when Real Madrid clinched their 3rd consecutive title. Or, for example, even in the 1950s when they won it 5 times on the bounce as well. So, just, yeah, very strange. Very, very strange.
Imagine if, like, every competition was like that, and it was just, we'd slowly get to a point where there's no football tournaments left, but all we've got left to watch is like the Azerbaijani second division. It's like the only football we can still watch. So in 1912, Porto joined efforts with Le Choix, and I will apologise for any bad Portuguese pronunciation in this episode, to establish the Porto Football Association, which began organising the Porto Regional Championship in the following year.
The founding clubs for this championship were immediately joined by many other clubs, including some from outside the district. Today, it's the largest football district association in the country, with 340 clubs and 19,000 plus athletes in all age range categories. And it still exists on tiers 4 to 7 on the Portuguese footballing pyramid.
Porto finished their first season in this new local tournament as runners-up behind their rival Boa Vista, but in the following season the club would win its very first championship.
Around this time, Porto, unsatisfied with the already ahead of the curve stadium, began searching for a site to build an even bigger stadium as they'd outgrown their current 600-seater home, plus the local council wanted to build its own factory on the current site.
So the outcome of that was the Campo de Constitucio, or the Constitution Field in English. The new stadium was a massive step up, going from, like you said, the 600 seats now to a capacity of 20,000. It's pretty sad that, you know, the driving force behind reactivating the club, Jose Monteiro de Costa, didn't actually live to see his club take to the field at this brand new 20,000 capacity stadium.
And this is still in 1920. This is in the 20s. Like, wow.
Which is mad when you think a few years ago, before he came back from England, the club had already started and then finished, and what he's started has now become this club at a 20,000 seat stadium. I think it's pretty impressive.
By the end of the 1920-21 season, Porto had been regional champion 6 times in 7 years, so continuing the domination they would see in the future. And outright winners of the Taça de Jose Montenegro Cup, as we've mentioned before, after claiming it for the 3rd consecutive time.
All of this success on regional level, but like a lot of countries outside of like England at this point, you're still playing in your regional leagues. The 21-22 season was marked by the creation of the first nationwide football competition, the Campeonato de Portugal, which is literally the Championship of Portugal.
Organised by the National Federation, this knockout tournament gathered the winners of various regional championships to determine the Portuguese champion. It worked simply as if you won your regional league, you would then be entered into this kind of knockout battle between all the different regions and see who would be the best. Therefore, that would be the winner of the Championship of Portugal.
So after clinching their 4th consecutive regional title, Porto defeated Sporting in the inaugural edition and became the first Portuguese national champion.
The regional champions from the Algarve, Lisbon, Madeira and Porto were all invited to take part in this newly formed tournament. But due to the organisational and financial problems, the Algarve and Madeira's FA's teams would not be able to participate, and thus the competition was only featured with 2 teams, the Lisbon champions, Sporting CP, and Porto's champions, FC Porto.
So this meant the winner of the inaugural Campeonato de Portugal would be determined essentially by a best of 3 series. So the teams would face each other in 2 legs, home and away, and then the final would only be played if each team had won one of the games or if both games ended in a draw. If it did come to that situation, the final would be played on a neutral ground and could carry on to extra time and penalties if necessary.
Porto would win the first game, or the first leg, 2-1, which was held at the Campo de Constituto. Interestingly, this game was refereed by an Englishman by the name of Merrick Barley. There's zero information on him anywhere, but he seemed to referee a couple of other Portuguese matches from what we could find. But yeah, very strange to have another English connection to northeastern Portugal here.
I think he was on holiday and he got roped into it by the looks of it. He's like refereed like about 3 Portuguese games and that's it. But yeah, Sporting would win the second match 2-0. So with both teams winning a game each, this actually forced the sides to this third and final game, where Porto would win the game 3-1 to clinch the first ever national title.
During this time of early success for FC Porto, they were spearheaded by an English forward, Norman Hall. Before joining Porto at the age of 25, Hall had played for Staines Town, Woking and Chesterfield in England. And the English striker was the first foreigner to represent the Dragons in the national competition.
It's not your usual career path to Porto and Portuguese football, is it? Staines, Woking and Chesterfield. But yeah, a massive milestone in the club's history, and it's a fact that's actually marked by a statue that's located at the entrance of the club museum.
He would stay at the club for 9 seasons between 1922 to 1931, and in total he played 71 games, scored 57 goals, and whilst all during that period winning 7 regional titles plus Porto's 2nd Portuguese championship in 1925, and he scored in the final 2.
And so while Porto were a dominant regional force, the club faced stronger opposition in the national championship, so they won it 3 more times in the span of the next 16 years. So that was in 1925, 32 and 37. And for the 1934-35 season, a second nationwide competition named the Campeonato de Premier Liga, the Premier League Championship, or simply just the Primeira Liga, was established by the National Federation to increase the number of matches per season and improve the competitiveness of Portuguese football.
As the dominant regional powerhouse, Porto qualified for the first edition of this new competition, and they won it with 10 victories in the 14 matches.
And due to the success of this format, the Premier Liga was made an official championship competition for the 38-39 season. Its name changed to the Campeonato Nacional de Primeira Divisão, the First Division National Championship, or simply the Primeira Divisão. And this replaced the Campeonato de Portugal, which is in turn converted to the Taça de Portugal, the main domestic cup competition. That basically became the FA Cup, and this new thing was the Premier League, essentially.
A bit more digestible for us English folk here. Porto won the inaugural edition of the new league championship and successfully defended the title in the next season, despite almost failing to take part.
And that was because in the 39-40 season, the sixth season of the top tier football in Portugal, it was marked with controversy regarding the teams qualifying from the Porto regional championship. So this was due to an administrative battle there that was going on in the courts between FC Porto and Académica de Porto. And this was regarding a regional championship game that ended after only 43 minutes. The match was replayed, which Porto won, according to the Porto FA decision. But the Portuguese Federation came out with a decision to satisfy both clubs, expanding the divis out to 10 teams, so two from the Porto FA, which annulled the result from the repeated match and allowed both teams to join. Moving forward a few years, we'll get to another big milestone, despite it being a friendly match. So Porto defeated English champions Arsenal 3-2 in a friendly match. And to commemorate this victory, the associates offered the club a massive trophy made of 250 kilograms of silver and wood called the Arsenal Cup. So Arsenal very gracious in defeat, giving them a massive trophy. And it is huge. If you look at a picture of it, it's massive.
Having endured a 16-year title drought during this period, Porto returned to winning ways by taking the 1955-56 Primeira Divisão on a head-to-head advantage over runners-up Benfica.
Later that same season, Porto would beat Torense to win their first ever Taça de Portugal and achieve their first ever double. So a hell of a season.
And as the Portuguese league winner, Porto made its debut in European competition by qualifying for the 1956-57 European Cup.
The 56-57 European Cup is quite an interesting one because the English Football Association had not allowed Chelsea to enter in 1955 and continued its stance on the European Cup being a distraction. However, against the wishes of the FA, Manchester United entered the competition as English champions and becoming the first English team to play in Europe.
Which is mad to think of how dominant English teams have been in Europe and to think it was once deemed a distraction to play on the continent in the UK. But back to Portugal, the club's first participation was short-lived, ending in the preliminary round as they lost twice to Spanish champions Atletico Bilbao.
Yeah, Porto would lose 2-1 at home during the first leg. They'd fight bravely away in Bilbao, levelling the tie 3-3 on aggregate after 20 minutes. But two red cards in the last 20 minutes would make it just all unravel as Bilbao scored twice to make it 5-3 overall. So yeah, their first European adventure was over.
But however, back on the domestic campaign, Porto would narrowly lift their fifth National League title. The 1958-59 season would be won with a plus 59 goal difference to Benfica's plus 58. Very, very tight indeed.
Seriously tight. But this would actually be their last title for over 18 seasons as Portuguese football entered a period of Benfica and Sporting Lisbon domination. So Benfica getting 14 titles and Sporting getting the other four.
This league win would see them try and qualify for the European Cup once again, but sadly they would be dismantled home and away by the hands of Slovana Hrvatina Bratislava, beaten 2-1 in Slovakia and 2-0 at home.
So on the domestic front, like we said, the league title drought wouldn't end until 1978, and this was once again on goal difference, very narrowly, also over Benfica. And this year was also notable for the fact that Benfica came second, despite actually not losing a match throughout the entire season, so they went completely unbeaten.
To go completely invincible and to not win the league title must have been a bit of a kick in the teeth. But Porto only lost one game themselves, and it won it with a plus 60 goal difference to Benfica's plus 45, so fair play to Porto. They probably did deserve it despite losing that one extra game.
But imagine as a Benfica fan looking at that table when you played 30, won 21, drawn 9, lost 0, only conceded 11 goals all season, whereas Porto actually conceded 21. You'd be gutted, wouldn't you?
Hey, but Porto had the goals to thank from the likes of Fernando Gomes, academy product and a Porto-born player.
He powered them to back-to-back titles, so this is a name that's going to keep cropping up now. He was the top goalscorer in the division 3 years running with 26 goals, 25 goals and 27 goals. And he gave fans an early preview of this, getting 2 on his debut as a young 17-year-old. And he was present for all important moments during like this sort of second coming of, or probably third coming in the club. This rebirth, including the aforementioned 18-year Premier League drought, plus some more spectacular moments coming up soon.
He has an amazing quote saying that scoring a goal is just like having an orgasm, in which, well, he probably had a lot of orgasms, should we say? Because in his 431 career appearances, he would score 330 goals.
Yeah, I'm guessing he was a very happy man if all of those were orgasms. He also won 2 European Golden Shoes for his troubles, 6 Bola de Pratas, which was the Premier League award for the top goal scorer, and only Azubia has more, 7. And he's named in the FC Porto all-time best XI.
And to top all that off, he's also back at the club, just how we like to see it, a nice return for a hero of the club. And today he's in the scouting and youth department as the director of these departments at FC Porto.
Which is very impressive considering we're going to be talking about later on their fantastic scouting and youth development. So Fernando Gomes, not only was he banging him in at this point, he's also now, you know, signing up the next generations.
I wonder if his little quote about orgasms is how he's finding these players. Like, he's spotted this young Colombian talent and he goes up to him and asks him in Portuguese, like, so you've just scored 2 goals, how does that feel? And he was, and the player's like, oh, it was good. Nope, not signing him.
It was all right. Nah, you're not coming. Interestingly, something I found out which I didn't know. So ex-Benfica and of course Blackburn striker Nuno Gomes actually chose his name, his nickname, Gomes, in reference to Fernando Gomes.
So with the help of Fernando Gomes, Porto would now enter a sustained period of glory through the 1980s, both domestically and in Europe for the first time.
This would include winning 11 league titles in the next 15 seasons, which is like, yeah, no matter how you put it, is seriously impressive, especially when they've gone from that huge drought to then, yeah, like you say, sustained domination, basically.
To be more specific, it really kicked off in the 1983-84 season. In the league, they'd finished second behind Benfica, but incredibly only conceded 9 goals all season.
Very Mourinho-esque.
Foreshadowing a little bit there.
But yeah, they would put a cup run together this season to win the Taça de Portugal 4-1 against Rio Ave. But more impressively, coach José Mário Pedroto guided Porto on an epic European journey. And this was all the way to the final of the Cup Winners' Cup against Trapattoni's Juventus. And this Cup Winners' Cup is actually just 1 year after Aberdeen beat Real Madrid 2-1 to famously lift the trophy. If you don't know about that, shameless plug, go back, listen to the Aberdeen episode.
This is also the same campaign that links us from Aberdeen to Porto, in which, where Aberdeen unfortunately lost to Porto, but Porto beat Rangers en route to the final against Giovanni Trapattoni's Juventus. So maybe Aberdeen fans can take a little bit of solace by the fact that Rangers got a good beating as well. The final will be played out in Switzerland at the St. Jacob Stadium in Basel. The Juventus team they were playing against featured some huge superstars such as Paolo Rossi, Michel Platini and Zbigniew Boniek.
But the Italian team sadly proved to be too strong for Porto as they ended the match 2-1 winners. Boniek's 41st minute goal proved to be the crucial one and saw the trophy head back to Turin. And Fernando Gomes actually captained the Porto side on that night that interestingly featured an Irishman, an ex-Blackpool legend, Mickey Walsh.
This linking us all the way back to our first episode about the Seasiders. And funny enough, Mickey Walsh still lives in Porto, in Portugal, to this day.
There's some great interviews with him about his time in Portugal. He speaks about how it was harder to get people to sort of buy into him when he first got there. They all thought he was better than him, and this guy coming over from England. But he says once he proved it on the training pitch that he was as good, or if not better, than a lot of the players that were there, they accepted him. You know, at first they were like, who's this foreign guy, you know, taking one of our players' positions? But you get the respect once you're earning their bonuses.
He also speaks about the legacy of the team he was part of, saying, we are looked upon as the guys who started the modern iteration of Porto, so in this like third revival of the club, saying about how they got to the final of this Cup Winners' Cup in 84.
And that they were probably the best team in Europe at this time, but yeah, got beaten by Juventus. But that was the first major European final that Porto had ever been in. So he's still a legend to this day. Still has people come up to him in Porto to speak to him about these times, which is, yeah, it's very impressive.
Vignola. Looking for Boniek. And a goal for Juventus. Zbigniew Boniek. The Polish international puts Juventus back in front.
Following on from this finale defeat, the following season, a new coach took over the team, and it would be Arthur George.
He'd immediately helped Porto get over this final defeat and rally in the following 84-85 season as they won the top tier of Portugal, 8 points clear of Sporting, scoring 78 goals along the way and only conceding 13. So you're getting the best of both worlds here. You get scoring loads of goals, conceding barely any. And guess who took the golden boot that season?
Fernando Gomes. Who else? He netted 39 times in a 30-game season. Incredible, incredible.
The guy is an absolute machine. And he was actually crowned Europe's top goalscorer for the second time this year, after first taking the award in 83.
Porto would continue on and make it back-to-back league titles in 85-86 season, 2 points clear this time of Benfica in a tightly contested Primeira season.
So what we're seeing here is, like, they've had the first test of Europe, now they're dominating the league on the home front, and as we move into 1987, European Cup is where stuff starts getting very interesting.
So as league winners, this secured entry to the 1986 1987 European Cup process. In the first game, the club recorded its biggest win in European competitions, a 9-0 win against Maltese side Rabat Ajax.
The 9-0 win at home must have seriously settled the nerves for the away trip to Malta. I'm just loving the idea of Rabat Ajax being like, right, it's only half time, lads. You know, we've got another leg to go. Yeah, you know, we're still in this.
Fernando Gomez, that man again, picked up 4 goals in the first leg alone. But the pick of the bunch was the 4th goal on the night from Algerian striker Radban Magier as he thumped in a marvellous scissor kick.
Yeah, and he reached stardom as a Porto player during the 80s and is regarded as the best Algerian footballer of all time. And we'll look at him in some more detail very soon.
In the second round, Porto would face Czech side Vitkovice. Porto would actually lose 1-0 in Ostrava, but comfortably turn the tie around back at home with a 3-0 win.
It was actually Porto's centre-back Celso who grabbed the second goal with a vicious strike from a free kick nearly 40 yards out from goal.
Watching the highlights of this, it was just the classic Brazilian centre-back who can just, like, smash home free kicks. We will mention them many more times in the upcoming rest of the podcast. But yeah, this Celso, he just had an eye with a dead ball.
It's giving me strong Alex vibes at Chelsea when he just used to run up and just absolutely smash it, didn't he? Yeah. But now we're into the quarterfinals, and Porto fans have got to be dreaming now just a little bit, haven't they? So the next team they're up against that stand between them and a semi-final spot is Danish team Brøndby. Porto would record a 1-0 win at home in the first leg, and it was Magier that got the lone winner in the 71st minute with a tidy near post finish.
Brøndby would respond in the second leg, however, getting themselves level in the tie just 21 minutes into the first half. But with 15 minutes to go, Brazilian striker Drury would get a crucial away goal that settled the tie and booked Porto a slot in the semi-finals.
Semi-final time now. So up steps Ukrainian team Dynamo Kiev. At this point, they're part of the USSR, so not Ukrainian. Soviet team Dynamo Kiev.
The starting goalkeeper for Porto at the time was Polish goalkeeper Josef Mynarczyk. He was quoted as saying at the time that the coach had instructed them to go to Dynamo's evening training sessions and watch them before the match. The opponent was dangerous, but we went into the match with full of optimism after, I'm guessing, spying on all their little secrets, I'm guessing.
Yeah, full on Bielsa style, isn't it? So the first leg would be played at the Estadio de Santos with Porto needing to lay down a marker early in the tie. But it would be Kiev who made the most impact in the early stages, even having a goal chalked off for being offside as Porto survived an early scare.
The breakthrough, however, would come shortly in the second half for Porto. Paulo Futre would receive the ball on the far side of the pitch, just entering the final third as he collects the ball. With the pace he had, he touches the ball past one Kiev player. He cuts inside towards the box as another Kiev player closes him down. He dances away from him as well with great balance just before he's taken down. But just as he managed to loop a shot up and over the goalkeeper and put Porto 1-0 up with this magical individual run.
Outstanding solo goal and matched with a brilliant celebration as well as he sprints over to the Porto fans, jumps onto the fence, penning them in, climbs to the top and just extends a single arm over the top, and like the fans are climbing up to meet him as well. Like, yeah, top celebration for a quality goal.
The game all of a sudden came to Porto as Dynamo attacked for the equaliser. They could sit back and counter at speed with the likes of Paulo, as we've just said. This would lead to a red card for Kiev centre-back Bal, as he was the last man and cut down Festas on the counter for what would have been a golden opportunity.
So with an extra man, Porto now really did have the advantage, and this was compounded when a Kiev player thought he was playing volleyball. He tried to make a header, only for the ball to come bouncing off his hand for a stonewall penalty. Up steps Andre. He slots it easily to keep his left to double the advantage. Dynamo do get a goal back in the 73rd minute, so setting up the second leg nicely. And we're going to be at the Republican Stadium with a packed out crowd of 100,000 people.
The game would kick off at a wild pace with the ball being pinged around the pitch before a Kiev player is just a second late in the tackle and concedes a foul 30 yards out from goal.
Take two, just like in the second round earlier on. Celso, the Brazilian centre-back, stands over the free kick. And while the Dynamo keeper is trying to sort out his wall, Celso spots a cheeky opportunity to take it quickly and smashes it.
Before the keeper can set himself, the ball is already nicked off the wall and rolled into his goal. Some brilliant quick thinking from Porto's number 5 to get them off to the perfect start after only 3 minutes on the clock. What a brave move from this Brazilian centre-back.
Maybe Trent Alexander-Arnold with his quick corners was actually like doing his best Celso impression of Porto. Yeah.
Fernando Gomes would put the Porto fans into a dream world, instinctively meeting a ball at the back post to tuck home, making it 2-0 after just 11 minutes, making it 4-1.
Yeah, but they don't like to make it easy for themselves. themselves, do they? So just 2 minutes later, the Portuguese defence just allow Mikhailchenko to turn and fire home a sweet strike off the post, 4-2 on aggregate now.
Just 10 minutes later, they'd have another scare FC Porto as Mikhailchenko's overhead kick would rattle the crossbar in fantastic style, but they would scramble it away.
So Porto would have to survive this unrelenting pressure from the home team, with just coping on a few breaks on the counter to give them a chance and let the defence have a breather. But for all the team from the Soviet Union tried, they just couldn't breach the defence. So as the final whistle went, Porto confirmed their place in the 86-87 European Cup final. Wow.
The Polish goalkeeper Josef once again would state, "Our defence played very well. All the situations created by the Soviet Union team were saved either by me or the defending players. We won the game 2-1, which was a surprise and a disappointment for many Soviet professionals."
I'll be getting a few visits from the KGB after that one, probably. So the final was to be played out at the Prater Stadion in Vienna, Austria. It's now actually the Ernst Happel Arena, which is another plug for our second episode, Hamburg.
Ernst Happel, the HSV legend that guided them to European Cup, which again, a little bit more foreshadowing for what's going to happen here at FC Porto.
And they were going to be facing Bavarian giants Bayern Munich. Bayern had overcome Real Madrid in the semi-final, beating them 4-2 in aggregate after blitzing the Spaniards 4-1 at home. In the second leg, Real Madrid fans being very classy, throwing objects, golf balls and stuff onto the pitch in protest.
This Bayern Munich team featured the likes of Lothar Matthäus, Hansi Flick and Dieter Hoeneß, all legendary figures for the national team as well.
But absolute huge thing, Porto would be without arguably their best player, that man we've sort of spoke about so much already, Fernando Gomez, due to injury. And bookmakers had Porto at 19-1 to win the final, so they were strongly considered underdogs.
It would kick off with a brilliant atmosphere ringing around the stadium being created by both sets of fans. But after a cagey opening 20 minutes, it would be the Bavarians who took the advantage from some slack Porto defending.
Just 24 minutes on the clock and Dieter Hoeneß would get a throw-in on the near side for Bayern, deep in Porto territory. His long throw was launched straight into the box and was half-headed clear, but Ludwig Hugel reacted quickly to nod the rebounding ball back towards the goal and catch Josef Milinacic out of position. It's 1-0 to Bayern, and Porto have not even started yet and they're down.
Porto would reply with a decent spell of possession, but the game quickly returned to a fractured 50-50 tie with little quality in front of either goal.
Apart from Celso, of course, unleashing a massive long-range attempt from a free kick just before half-time, there wasn't a great deal of chances. It wasn't a hugely exciting game of football. But plenty of tough tackling, just very, very 80s probably. Yeah.
Early in the second half, Porto continued to build into the game, full of quick passing, moves and direct running. Their goal-scoring chances would still be limited, but the pressure and momentum was starting to build. Around the 50th minute mark, Magier's volleyed effort becomes the first chance that Porto really have for levelling the game as he volleys agonisingly just over the bar.
Talk about pressure being on Magier in this game with Gomez out. They're relying on him to bring the goods. So Bayern, at this point in the game, seemed to be offering not a great deal in attack, apart from the odd sort of set-piece and counter-attack, until all of a sudden they get a penalty decision waved away almost out of the blue.
Ludwig Kohl's dribbling was just a bit too quick for the Porto captain, João Pinto, and the striker just gets ahead of the defender before being brought down. On further inspection with a slow-mo replay, it's a stonewall penalty and Porto are incredibly lucky to only concede a corner. Strangely, apart from Cole, none of the Bayern players really appeal for it, strangely. But yeah, second viewing with the replay, Porto, wow, very lucky to get away with that.
So as the game entered the final 20 minutes after that scare, Porto still knocking on the door, still in the game. But some clean, calm defending from Bayern Munich, doesn't sound like them, does it, of course, continued to stifle out Porto's attacks and the potential opportunities for them. And in the 77th minute, Porto set in motion another attack.
The long ball is collected by Jauri, who lays it back to Antonio Frasco before making a darting run into the box. Frasco plays a slicing ball back to Jauri as he cuts into the Bayern defence. He takes the ball on the turn and holds off the defender before firing a blocked effort that falls perfectly for Raban Magier in the 6-yard box.
And there he is, Magier, the man when they needed him. He's back to goal, he calmly backheels the ball into the goal, cool as you like. He takes one look over his shoulder before checking it's in and then raises his arm in celebration, falling to his knees as he gets mobbed by his teammates. So now the momentum shifts with Porto, lifted by the goal, and they've found a second wind.
It only takes 3 minutes for Porto to find that second goal, and this time it's Magier repaying the favour for Jauri. Magier is sprinting down the near touchline. He takes on Helmut Winkelhofer and leaves him for dead before swinging in a delicious ball towards the back post for an onrushing Jauri to simply tap home. It's a quickfire double that now sees Porto out of nothing, leading for the first time in this final.
A European Cup final. It's a hell of a change around. So Porto, of course, now sort of try and shut up shop. Little fouls to break up the game, break up the rhythm. Goalkeeper doing the classic falling to the floor when he collects the ball, kicking the ball away, needing to stretch for cramp. You know, we're getting the full works of shithousery, basically.
As a member of the goalkeepers union in Sixerside, I fully commend this type of play. This type of, I want to say, spitzhousing in the nice, non-expletive way.
Yeah, well, when we first saw this goalkeeper, I just thought it was a video of Joey playing. I've seen this many times, yes.
Bayern keep hold of the ball, try to build this pressure, but it's Porto who looks more dangerous for the final 10 minutes with their devastating counter-attacks. However, it's not needed, as with all their game management, which I say with air quotes, the minutes just melt away until the final whistle, which sees FC Porto crowned as the European Cup winners after this fantastic comeback.
What an achievement. Absolutely incredible. Josef Milniacic, the goalkeeper, said like the euphoria after winning the cup was just incredible. And when they got back to Porto in the middle of the night, they got to the coach and the fans had already stripped them of all of their clothes and any other mementos they could find. And afterwards, he said, they didn't go to sleep, but they went straight to the stadium where the official presentation of the trophy was arranged at 6 o'clock. So yeah, I can imagine one hell of a party atmosphere going on there.
I would have loved to have seen some of the scenes on that plane flying them back from Austria.
Another rare sad moment there when we think back to Montero da Costa at the beginning. His team has now achieved what he set out to do with the whole blue and white thing. You know, they are the team representing Portugal, European champions.
Vai para a área o brasileiro. Frasco para Juari. Marger com espaço, vai marcar, golo! Mas no Estádio do Prato, era em Viena. Acompanhou o movimento do Marger e recebeu o passe de Juari, marcando de calcanhar.
So we can't sort of move on from that final until we just have a little bit more detail on Rabah Madjer, who got the all-important equaliser and the assist for the winning goal. Let's just take a little bit more of a look at his career and his career at Porto in particular.
He had the nickname Mustafa, and the Algerian-born, due to his successes at FC Porto, as he's mentioned, is widely regarded as one of the best Algerian football players of all time. He's racked up 9 major titles during his 6-year spell at Porto, including the aforementioned 87 European Cup. And he started his career at Algerian club N.A. Hussein Dey and worked his way up to 58 goals over a 5-year spell in his homeland.
His first big move would be to France with Racing Club de Paris in 1983. He'd helped them get promoted to the top tier, scoring 20 goals in 27 games in his debut season in France. But, you know, the top tier proved a little bit of a tougher environment, and he only got 3 goals in that following campaign as Racing Club just managed to stay up.
But from here, this is where Madjer arrived at FC Porto ahead of the 1985-86 season, and the following campaign he entered the club's history books with the goals and the assist against Bayern Munich.
The goal he scored with the back heel, Pelé is actually believed to have said of this goal, "It would have been the greatest goal I've ever seen if he had not looked back at it." So if he'd have just walked off and left it, which, you know, fair enough, but come on, Pelé, give the guy a break.
It would have been ice cold, though, if he had just, like, walked back to the centre circle, not even celebrated. Like, yeah, I do this all day. What? European Cup final? Did this in my sleep, mate.
Milniacic actually said about Madjer that he was the most versatile and complete player he ever played with. And he said he was a player that had everything, a good left, a good right foot. And he had speed, agility, like, amazing technique, and great jumping ability, like literally everything. Like, there was one of those players where just no real weak side to his game.
He'd average a goal every 2 games during his time in Portugal with 138 games while scoring 71 goals. Madjer even had success on the international stage as he would help Algeria reach their first ever World Cup finals.
Yeah, that would be the 1982 World Cup in Spain, and then would repeat the same feat for the 86 World Cup in Mexico as well.
After his magnificent performance in that European final, Madjer won the Ballon d'Or de Africa. But unfortunately, he was not allowed to compete for the European Golden Ball Ballon d'Or that we all know now because he was not born in Europe, which is just a bit of a sad thing to hear.
Yeah, yeah. It's good that that's not a thing anymore, isn't it?
Yeah. Lionel Messi, quite thankful.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this earned him a move in 1988 to Inter Milan. Sadly, in his medical, they detected a serious thigh muscle injury that he'd actually had before and not properly recovered from. Therefore, the contract was never officially signed, despite them having like an announcement and having pictures taken and everything. So the move would never actually go ahead.
But, however, he would move on from Porto and would instead sign on loan for Valencia, but then remained at Porto for 3 seasons, winning another league title and another Taça de Portugal.
He'd actually gone to manage the Algerian national team in 4 different stints between 1993 and 2017, plus also managing at youth level for Porto as well. A real not just a Porto legend, but an Algerian legend.
Magier is the perfect type of character that we like to find when we're doing the research for these podcasts. This type of clearly a man ahead of his time, a brilliant talent, a man who really stepped up and was a star for Algeria, a star for Africa, a star for Porto. Someone who we'd never heard of in all honesty before doing the research.
Exactly, it's fascinating once you sort of read into it and realise, yeah, what a good player he was.
Back to FC Porto, back to the story of the club. Arthur Hodge, or Ray Arthur, or King Arthur in English, as fans called him after the European Cup victory, would unfortunately leave the club and took the reins at Racing Paris, the club that Magier had started his European career at.
It's an interesting, very random little link, but what I found really fascinating, when you first see it and you're like, this guy just won the European Cup with Porto, why the hell is he leaving for Racing Paris? Interestingly, in 1982, they were actually bought by a rich local businessman who invested into the club and wanted to build a team of stars. I find it quite interesting what we're seeing happening at PSG now, sort of already happened before with Racing Paris. And this guy was called Jean-Louis Lagardère. And basically, he bought the club, who at the time had a debt of more than 4 million French francs, and renamed it Paris Racing One. And he invested in like big experienced names, and he was determined to get a famous coach to lead this team. So by 1987, he hired Arthur George after his European Cup glory. However, none of this quite went to plan. The club fell on hard times, struggled to attract fans, and during the late 1980s, the club actually lost 300 million francs. So maybe this is a precursor of what will happen to PSG, maybe. Who knows?
On top of also losing their pioneering manager, the Dragons also lost one of their most important players. Paulo Futre would join the ranks of Atletico Madrid for a record fee in Portugal, the modern equivalent being 3 million euros.
Yeah, he'd actually earn a salary of over 650,000 while in Madrid as well. So, yeah, some serious money spent on him. But he would later become infamous for a very short spell at West Ham United. Actually, only playing 9 games, but, you know, people might remember him for his refusal to play for the club until he was given his favoured number 10 shirt. He actually stormed out of what would have been his debut against Arsenal at Highbury after discovering that midfielder John McCall was wearing his number 10 shirt, which he had spotted throughout all of pre-season. There's a great quote from him, where he said, we'd agreed on a contract clause that said he would play with number 10. Then came our first game at Arsenal. I'd warmed up, had a shower. I was about to get changed when I saw the number 16 jersey waiting for me with my name on. I shouted, no, not fucking 16, number 10. Very angry man.
But despite this kind of odd story of his time in England, Paulo Futre was like a star for FC Porto at the time, as he was the man of the match in the final against FC Bayern Munich.
On the management front, Arthur George would be replaced by Tomislav Ivic. Big shoes to fill after winning the European Cup. But we've just got to take a moment to look at his footballing CV, because it is pretty incredible. He is a journeyman in the true sense of the word, isn't he?
We've got to stand up and applaud this man's footballing managerial career. Tomislav managed teams in 14 countries, along with 4 national teams as well. He won titles and cups in 7 of those countries: Yugoslavia, the Netherlands, Belgium, Portugal, Spain, and even France.
A little quirk just from looking at the teams he managed here is like he managed the same country under 2 guises, so like Yugoslavia and Croatia, which I don't know how many other people have done that, but that's quite an interesting one.
His managerial career would start off in Split with RNK Split, where he also played, Hajduka Split, where he also managed the youth teams, then it's Sabinjek, then it's the Yugoslavian national team, back to Hajduka Split, then he manages his first non-Croatian team, or non-Yugoslavian team, with Ajax, then he's back to Hajduka Split, then he's off to Belgium with Anderlecht, Galatasaray, Dynamo Zagreb, back to Croatia once again, Panathinaikos, Porto is where we come to cross with him now. He also then carries on and goes to PSG, Atletico Madrid, Marseille, Benfica as well, so he also crosses the big 3 divide, Fenerbahce, the United Arab Emirates national team, Al Wasal, back to Hajduka Split for like what I feel like is the 5th time, and then there's Iran, Standard Liège, Marseille again, and then one last time in Al Ittihad.
He certainly got about a bit, didn't he? Pretty amazing. One of the interesting things with him, he has one of the best Champions League win ratios of any manager of all time, having won 29 out of 46 matches with a ratio of 63%.
So this isn't even one of those like little stupid win ratios where, say, he's played 5, won 5 with a 100% record. No, he's competed. 46 games is a healthy amount in the top tier of European football.
And getting there, like really deep into the competition as well. Like he took Hajduk Split to the European Cup quarter final twice, 75-76 and 79-80. And also did the same with Ajax in 77-78. His biggest achievement in the European Cup was actually reaching the semi-finals during the 81-82 season with Anderlecht. So it's pretty impressive that the clubs he did the best in Europe with, and not necessarily the biggest ones he managed, like PSG, Atletico and things like that. It's very, very impressive.
He was often described as a brilliant strategist. Ivic was credited with helping develop the modern style of the game. Even in the modern day, in 2007, Italian papers proclaimed him as the most successful manager in history due to his 7 league titles won in 5 different countries.
To bring it back to Porto, Ivic would build on the glory of last season as Porto entered the European Super Cup and Intercontinental Cup.
Obviously, they went into the match as the European champions, but their opponents in the Super Cup would be veterans of the competition. It would be Dutch team Ajax they would face, who had appeared in the first edition and earned another chance to reclaim their crown thanks to Marco van Basten's winner against FC Lokomotive Leipzig in the Cup Winners' Cup in the previous May.
And the tie would take place over 2 legs, but it's only the second time that a second leg was played in a different year to when both teams had won their trophies. The first leg being in November 87 and the second leg being in January 88.
This Ajax team boasted several members of the Netherlands squad that would go on to win the 1988 Euros. Just a few of the names from their team would be Danny Blind, Frank Rijkaard, Arnold Mulren, John Bosman and a very young Dennis Bergkamp.
Yeah, as well as Irishman Frank Stapleton of ex-Arsenal and Manchester United goal machine, who was also there at Ajax at the time.
Despite all these storied names, it would be Porto who'd put on a show over the 2 legs.
So the first leg in Amsterdam would finish 1-0 to Porto thanks to an early Rui Barra score within 5 minutes of the kickoff. And this match would actually lead to the sacking of Ajax legend Johan Cruyff. The second leg took place almost 2 months later in Porto, with the result being repeated thanks to Antonio Souza's goal, 2-0 on aggregate. Porto are crowned Super Cup winners and get to lift the trophy in front of their home fans, a bit like Aberdeen last time out.
Another consequence of winning the European Cup, FC Porto were sent to represent Europe in the Intercontinental Cup, or now what is known as the Club World Cup. The match were between Porto, as the winners of the European Cup, and Peñarol of Uruguay as the winners of the 1987 Copa Libertadores.
The match was played in a neutral venue, which was the National Stadium in Tokyo, in front of 45,000 fans. Taking place in December 87, so this game actually takes place the month in between the 2 Super Cup matches. So they literally had Cup Final in November, Cup Final in December, Cup Final in January. It's a pretty intense few months.
And to add to the intensity, this mat was just covered in heavy snow as it fell just continuously through the game. If you watch the highlights on YouTube, it makes the quality of them just look terrible because there's just this white fog all the time as this snow just falls and falls all game long.
So the pitch was a bit of a mess and some very tough playing conditions. But 2 very familiar names would get on the score sheet for Porto. So first one out, who are you thinking? For the first goal, Porto player jinks inside and fires a shot that beats the goalkeeper. The ball gets stuck in the snow and stops just before the goal line. Up steps Fernando Gomez. He's there to scramble the ball in. Probably one of the stranger goals he scored in his career.
They all count though, and if it's tapping it in from 2 yards out just like this, or, I don't know, slotting it home.
I mean, that was Gary Lineker's whole career, wasn't it? Scoring from 2 yards out. So.
Or Dave Nugent in his England one cap career.
Hey, no one can take that away from Dave Nugent.
And no one could take this goal away from Fernando Gomez either. However, it would seem like the Portuguese team coped better in these blizzard conditions, winning 2-1 after extra time. And guess who but Magier, with his genius shining through once again as he scored a remarkable 109th minute winner in extra time.
Yeah, he actually nipped the ball off the toes of a Peñarol defender. He spots the keeper through the snow, like somehow through these blizzard conditions, off his line and lifts the ball over him from 30 yards out. Ball has just enough on it to crawl over the line. Doesn't need Gomez to tap it in this time. Just some incredible quick thinking to get the win in, yeah, these crazy conditions.
You can see how much this game meant for both teams, as when Peñarol score their equaliser, they run together in a big group, and you can see that it looks like they're almost in tears. All the players during this game as well, are they're all wearing gloves. It must have been freezing, awful conditions that, yeah, tough, tough stuff, but Porto dug deep and got the winner.
Josef Milniacic sums up these conditions quite well, the Polish goalkeeper for Porto. He says the previous day at training, there was just no indication that they'd be playing in these kind of conditions. But on the match day, it started raining in the morning, which then turned into snow, and the temperature dropped quickly below zero. There was about a 10-centimetre layer of snow on the pitch with water underneath as well, so it's icy, it's snowy, it's a mess. So neither team actually went out to warm up, and both wanted to start the game, literally on the move, come straight out, start the game. And he says, actually, when it came to the equaliser, he was so cold and wet after that goal, like diving around in the snow and mud. He didn't want to do anything else. He said he didn't even want to make another step. Like, it was that cold and horrible.
You can see how tough these conditions were for both sets of players.
I mean, I've been on some Sunday league pitches in Hull and that was pretty cold, so this sounds bad.
De Souza. Estamos quase a chegar aos 5 minutos da segunda parte do prolongamento. Madger a ganhar a bola. O chapéu e o golo! É um grande golo, mais um de Rab um toque perfeito, um chapéu larguíssimo a Pereira, um golo fabuloso na neve de Tóquio.
But to round out a truly incredible season with the Super Cup and the Intercontinental Cup, Tomislav Ivic would also lead FC Porto to a dominant league title win.
They only lost once throughout the season, which was away to Sporting, but finished a whopping 15 points ahead of Benfica, and they only conceded 3 goals at home all season and scored 56 overall. So the table, just to give you an idea of this domination, so they played 38, won 29, drew 8, lost 1, scoring 88 goals with 15 conceded. So a hell of a season. You've got more European success, world success, and dominating on a home front as well. And just to top it off, the local lad, Fernando Gomez, who we keep going on about, got another 21 goals that season to be Porto's top goal scorer.
We also had Rui Barrios getting 12 and Antonio Souza also getting 12 as well. So yeah, talk about the season ticket holders of FC Porto. That was value for money that season. 3 cups, loads of goals, away days to Japan if you wanted to go. Don't think it would have gone if you knew the snow, but hey, but yeah, wow, what a season after winning the European Cup.
Truly incredible, and what a sort of great era and few seasons for the club, like absolutely fantastic. It's always going to be tough to follow up on those kind of highs. And in the following 88-89 season, the slump, if you can say that, to second place behind Benfica. And this actually opened the door to the return of Arthur George, the guy who had left to go to the Paris club with the money, who'd won the European Cup. He comes back and leads them to a league title in the 89-90 season.
15 years after his first team debut, the homegrown legend that we've mentioned so many times, Fernando Gomez, played his last season for Porto. This is where he became the all-time top goal scorer with 352 goals in 455 matches.
As the club is now entering this sort of new era, like they do it without Fernando Gomez, and what a player he's been, what a servant to the club. Arthur George would stick around for the following season to bring us into the 90s, but would narrowly lose a title to Benfica by 2 points, despite only losing twice all season. So these season after season, these Portuguese leagues, it's so competitive between these top two or three teams. It's almost like what we're getting in the Premier League at the moment, where it's like you can't afford to lose any games because that's the league gone already. But they would beat Bayern Munich in the Taça de Portugal 2-0 in the final.
Arthur would once again step aside prior to the 1991-92 season, with Brazilian Carlos Alberto Silva coming into the dugout.
Interestingly, Arthur George would then go to PSG in 91-92, where he won the national championship with them in 93-94. So he just loves Paris and clubs with money, I think.
Paris Saint-Germain at this point weren't owned by the Qatari state, so maybe a little bit. We'll give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt.
We can let him off on that one.
But with Carlos Alberto Silva in the dugout, as we've mentioned, he'd win back-to-back league titles in his first two seasons and qualified Porto for the first iteration of the UEFA Champions League.
Porto entered the Champions League at the first round stage, beating Union Luxembourg over 2 legs, 9-1. In the second round, they kept scoring the goals, where they played FC Sion of Switzerland, beating them 6-2 on aggregate.
Sadly, however, this is where the new iterations of this European tournament came into effect and wouldn't really help Porto, as they sadly wouldn't make it out of the group stage, finishing third behind AC Milan and IFK Gothenburg. AC Milan would make it to the final, where they would lose 1-0 to Marseille.
The first ever Champions League final, actually turned out to be the last game of Milan's highly accomplished but injury-prone forward, Marco van Basten. He was only 28 at the time, and he was subbed off in the 86th minute due to fatigue and another ankle injury, and he would spend the next 2 years in recovery before announcing his retirement in August 1995.
So Porto played their part before the end of a legendary career with Marco van Basten. Despite Carlos Alberto's success, FC Porto would welcome back our Yugoslavian journeyman once again for the 93-94 season, Tomislav Ivic, from rivals Benfica this time.
However, midway through the season, Porto decide to make a managerial change, and it's one that's going to be a very familiar name for a lot of our listeners and an absolute legend. It is, of course, Sir Bobby Robson, who at the time was managing Sporting Lisbon in Portugal, had been there since 1992, and he'd been let go during the season. 3 months later, Porto mix things up, they move on Tomislav Ivic, and they bring in Sir Bobby Robson. So Robson is now Porto manager.
Just to give a little bit of extra context to why this legendary managerial figure would end up in Portugal. Well, he'd been the manager of the English national team for 3 tournaments in which they were all featured heartbreak or disappointment in some form or another.
Yeah, of course. The 1986 World Cup, England were eliminated after the literal hands of Maradona. We were eliminated at the hands of Maradona. We don't need to go into detail about that one. And then next up at the 88 Euros, England crashed out of the group stage, collecting 0 points to finish behind the Soviet Union. These are very dark days. The Netherlands and the Republic of Ireland. England could save some face in that the two finalists both qualified out of this group. But yeah, Bobby Robson at that point was under severe pressure, but in typical Robson style, showed his grit and determination to rebuild.
England would then qualify entering the 1990 World Cup in Italy as underdogs, as you can kind of expect from their prior performance in the Euros. However, after a stuttering start, they saw off the likes of Egypt, Belgium and Cameroon, and West Germany would be England's semi-final opponents. But Robson's team failed to progress after a penalty shootout defeat. Oh, that fabled story time and time again of England losing on penalties.
Before the England job, Robson had achieved incredible things at Ipswich Town. He'd won the UEFA Cup, an FA Cup, and an astonishing stat, like during his 13-year time there, he only actually bought 14 players from other clubs. Everything else, everyone else, all developed through the club's academy, which is just astonishing.
In typical Bobby style, after his departure from the England job, he stated, "Where'd you go after you've left the England job? I've decided to work abroad."
So in 1992, following back-to-back Eredivisie titles with PSV, he then comes to Sporting Club de Portugal.
Bobby stating, "I went to Lisbon, it was a magnificent city. Another country, another philosophy, another form of football. A proper student of the game," Bobby Robson is.
And another student of the game that he would then meet during his time in Lisbon would be a translator, because he didn't yet know the language, and the club recognising that he was unable to even order a drink in Portuguese, much less like be able to convey a tactical idea to a group of footballers, the club started the hunt for a translator.
This is where we come into contact with another legendary Porto figure, Jose Mourinho, who would later become a crucial member of Robson's backroom staff at Sporting.
You know, on the face of it, there are two guys who have completely different outlooks about football, but it actually led to a very successful relationship. Mourinho much preferred to, you know, approach games analytically, so there's no surprises on match days, whereas Robson didn't sort of rely on tactics as much, and players would be willing to go the extra mile for him, run through brick walls for him, because of just the admiration they have for this guy, you know, his experience and his achievements.
It feels like Mourinho was the brain, tactically, analytically, and Robson was the determination and the passion. You can see why that would work so harmoniously and successfully.
And despite Sporting Lisbon actually sitting top of the league in December 1993, they had actually had an early exit from the UEFA Cup at the hands of Casino Salzburg. This actually led to the club president relieving Robson of his duties.
And this is where we meet up back with what we've spoken about before. Tomislav Ivic was moved on from FC Porto, and Robson was almost immediately offered the managerial post. He'd be given the reins of the Dragons in the January of 1994, with Mourinho also appointed as his assistant manager.
And Porto, at this point, were actually in a very poor state. Like, when Robson arrived, the average attendance at the games had dwindled down to about 10,000, so, you know, they're in a real lull now.
We say lull, but this is like off the back of some amazing league-winning seasons just a couple of years before. But Robson would come in and revitalise the club once again. So maybe the fourth rebirth of FC Porto? Anyway, Robson enjoyed a tremendous success in his first season at Porto, reaching the Champions League semi-finals, as well as Porto only being 2 points off top spot in the League Two.
Just to make that even sweeter, the club went on to beat Robson's former club Sporting in the Taça de Portugal final, so just as a final screw you kind of thing. So his first half a season there at Porto is incredibly successful for the time he's had.
I'd love to imagine Bobby Robson just turning around, looking up into like the director's box of that final, just sticking two fingers up at the president who'd laid him off at Sporting CP, but I don't know, he's a nicer man than me, maybe.
He's far too nice for that.
During the European run, Porto would beat Maltese side Floriana 2-0, Feyenoord 1-0 to qualify for the group stage. But once again, they joined AC Milan plus Werder Bremen and Anderlecht in the group stage.
Highlight of this group stage would see them run riot against Werder Bremen at the Weserstadion, winning 5-0. Goals from Rui Felipe, Emil Kostaninov, Secretio Domingos and Timofte would put Porto in a commanding position in the group.
So, if any Hamburg fans are listening, I'm sure they'll be very chuffed with their Werder rivals being beaten so convincingly in their own backyard. Porto managed to grab a 0-0 draw against AC Milan as well and sealed second place in the group, squeezing ahead of Werder by just 2 points in the end as well. So, double delight for Hamburg fans.
And then, you know, just as you're building up this momentum, the draw comes out and you're drawn Barcelona in the semi-final, and the first leg being at the Nou Camp.
And it's one of these things, it's like this Barcelona team as well. Barcelona normally have like amazing teams, but it's like this Barcelona team. They had Ballon d'Or winner Hristo Stoichkov, little-known Brazilian that we also mentioned in the last episode, Romario, Michel Landrup, Ronald Koeman, who might not quite be as much of a Barcelona legend now, but anyway, at the time he was an amazing centre-back, goal-scoring centre-back. He also featured an Albert Ferrer and young Pep Guardiola in the team as well.
This is all while being managed by the legend Johan Cruyff, so yeah, it's a pretty solid outfit they've got there.
This also, you've got to remember, Porto had managed to get Johan Cruyff sacked at Ajax as well, so it's a little bit of a revenge mission for the legendary Dutch figure.
So you could say as well, it's a bit of an uphill task for Bobby's Porto to go to the Nou Camp and overcome this team, and unfortunately Barcelona would show their class with a 3-0 win. So a brace from Stochakov set Barcelona on their way within 35 minutes, and Koeman capped it off with another on the 72nd minute.
Things would come full circle, however, as Barcelona would be thumped by AC Milan in the final in Athens, as Fabio Capello's AC Milan won their fifth European title.
Yes, it's not a bad way to introduce yourself to your new employers, is it really? You know, getting to the semi-final of the European Cup, winning Ataque de Portugal, all just a few months really, get ready for his first full season, I think.
And things would only get better in his full first season, as Porto claimed the title, the 94-95 Primeira Divisão title, with a win at Sporting CP's ground as well. Bobby getting revenge once again.
That's really got to hurt Sporting, hasn't it? Like, so it's two times since he's left, he's won the cup against them. They win the league at their ground. That's got to hurt. Porto striker Domingos Paciência led the line wonderfully as he racked up 19 goals in the league. And interestingly, his son, Goncalo Paciência, currently plays for Frankfurt as well.
The following 95-96 season would get off to a tragic start, however, as 26-year-old midfielder Rui Felipe would die in a car accident in August. He had scored the club's first league goal of the season and was part of a team that would win the domestic Super Cup versus Benfica at the early stages of this season. So a kind of tragic way to start off the back of a legendary season.
And to add to that, Bobby Robson was struggling with health problems of his own. He had a malignant melanoma and missed the first few months of the season. However, he would triumphantly return and still successfully lead Porto to defend their league title, with Paciência again impressing as he'd grabbed the Bola de Prata with 25 goals this time around.
I could fully imagine Bobby using that type of stuff to like rally his troops and stuff. Something along the lines of like, lads, I might not have been here for the first half, but come on, let's show what we can do maybe, or something. Something along those lines.
Yeah, I think he's definitely a king of like using the emotion and like that side of the game, and I can definitely see that.
Bobby in his time at FC Porto assembled a fine-tuned, thrilling and an attacking side that got the most goals out of Domingos Paciência. This was also flanked by Ljubinko Djulovic and Rui Barrios.
So a very attacking front three, all getting their fair share of goals. But yeah, a phone call during the summer of 1996 from the current Barcelona vice president to discuss Luis Figo resulted in an offer of employment with the Spanish club. And Robson would take over in July 1996, where again his assistant was Mourinho. Robson had made Mourinho's move with him to the Nou Camp a condition of his employment. So, you know, Porto lose their manager, they also lose their assistant manager. Yeah, it's a real shame, an end of that era, but what an era it was. And he left Porto with a fantastic win ratio, 71.67%, two league titles, domestic cup and two super cups in his very short but very sweet stint at Porto.
He goes on to speak about his time in northern Portugal. I soon got the job at Porto, a wonderful club, a wonderful place to live. I won the Portuguese Cup and two championships and loved every minute of it.
And such was the impact of Robson at Porto and the football he played with that really attacking front three we spoke about. He was known to the locals as Bobby 5-0 in honour of the number of matches that Portugal actually won 5-0.
But also, it wasn't just the winning, the success, the trophies, the goals that Bobby brought to Porto. He would leave a lasting mark on a man who'd later return to the club for an equally iconic and successful period, the translator Jose Mourinho. Jose Mourinho would go on to state about Bobby Robson's stint at Porto, saying he really enjoyed working abroad. Different places, different cultures, different ways of living. Very similar to the quote we have from before. I always felt he had friends everywhere. In Lisbon, he was a Lisbon man. In Porto, he was a Porto man.
I think that sums him up brilliantly from the things you read from former players under him, former managers, people who were on his staff, that he was just a genuine, like, nice guy who made friends everywhere he went. And I think Mourinho is one of the best examples of that, and Mourinho still to this day holds him up, doesn't he, as the ultimate. I think that's just a great legacy.
You've got to think as well, his first influences aren't the only thing, because then obviously Mourinho would go on and influence more coaches, and it's like the roots of his influences must be huge now if we were to spend the time and dot all the different managers that are influenced by him going back through the years.
Definitely, and if you take into account the trophies that those people who he's influenced have then gone on to win, and you know the stuff that Mourinho went on to do at Porto and at Chelsea and stuff. Yeah, it's incredible. I think that's a great legacy to have, isn't it?
And on top of this like winning mentality and the success, I think one thing that makes him stand out when you think of these like legendary managerial figures is that I think I've never heard a bad word spoken about him. A single bad word spoken about him. For example, with an also legendary figure that we spoke about in the last episode, Sir Alex Ferguson. Don't get me wrong, he was also, as we've spoken about, a classy man, a thoughtful man, someone there for his players. But don't get me wrong, there's the fair share of stories where if you cross Fergie, he would bollock you, he would tell you. But maybe these things Bobby Robson did behind closed doors and just never came out. I don't know. Maybe we'll see in the future.
I soon got a job at Porto. Wonderful club, wonderful place to live in. I won this Portuguese Cup and two championships. And I loved every minute of it.
And with such a huge legend like Bobby Robson leaving the club, this feels like the perfect time to close our first chapter into our deep dive into Porto. But be sure to join us next time for a promotion for the translator, an unexpected Champions League, Premier League players galore, and more South American wonder kids than Football Manager.
So make sure to check us out on social media to keep up to date for when part two and many other episodes are coming your way, as well as also just footballing news and footballing tidbits. And keep an eye out as well for our football shirt giveaway, which is now a lovely little tradition we like to do. So that's all here for the journey for part one of our jump through FC Porto. There's not much else to say, so we'll see you all guys for part two. We've been the Journeyman. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Matt Reeves.
See you guys next time.
See you later.